This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 225, where AC and I are going to talk about the internet disappearing for a day, Office 365, and some Azure news, recorded live November 7th, 2017. Are you being asked repeatedly to integrate different business systems in ever narrower timeframes and with increasing process complexity? What if you could standardize the way you build these business processes so your team are focusing on higher value tasks versus the nuts and bolts of running the processes and integrations? Nintex can make it happen. With a Nintex platform, workflows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. Got a custom system you want to connect with? No-code extensions let you plug into systems simply and easily using REST and Swagger. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever. Try it out free for 30 days at www.nintex.com/try-NWC.
The internet's disappearing.
It's gone, Burger.
Oh!
Well, only in the US and only for certain customers, but yes, the internet disappeared. Not good.
How's it going,
CJ? How are you doing anyway, my friend?
Hey, it's a little scary when you say the internet goes away. It's scary.
Oh my God, let's put our laptops in our bags and go home.
No kidding. Yeah. Oh, too bad. That's where I am. Things are good, man. Let's see, what have we done since the last time we got together? Hey, last week was Halloween.
Yes.
You know what? For the first time I dressed up in 10 years.
Dude. You did not just dress up. You nailed it.
Man, I tell you what, it was very rewarding to see the reaction I got from a lot of people. So I dressed up as, I don't know, I have to find a way to put this picture. Oh, I guess I put a tweet out there, so I'll have to make a note to find a link to the tweet. I dressed up as the dude from The Big Lebowski, and it was just pretty easy. Got a wig, got a beard, got a mustache, got a bathrobe, threw one of my old white undershirts on, had to hike it up a bit to show a little bit of stomach, which was kind of tough because I've actually been working out and running a good bit, so I don't have much of a gut, so it's kind of hard to poke my gut out. Put on a pair of pajama pants, some white socks, and some sandals, and made a white Russian and went out to go trick-or-treating.
Nice.
You know what was so funny about it is that, so a bunch of friends got it, but you should have seen, none of the kids did, which wasn't surprising. It was disappointing, though. You could tell who the cool adults were because I got people asking me, hey, are you God? Are you Jesus? And then I was like, no, you totally missed that one. This is not like, you know, making water into wine. This was like making water into white Russians. And then...
are you Jesus?
And then there's other ones. So here's the other one that was funny, man. Some parent walks by and goes, oh, look, that's awesome. He's just being a regular old dad. And I'm like, wow, your house is totally embarrassing now.
That's hilarious. Oh, classic. That's actually pretty funny. I hadn't thought about that, but that's pretty good.
It was fun. I had a good time doing it. But man, I can tell you one thing. There's no way in hell this guy's going to have long hair anytime soon.
That's so good. Oh, man. I saw your photo and I thought it was hilarious. I dressed up as a middle-aged white IT guy. And yeah, that was about it. But my wife and kids, they're really into it. They had a great time. And of course, my wife, Vicky, she doesn't listen, so I can say this, but I'm pretty sure she loves it about as much as the children. And she goes and does stuff with the kids at school and all that sort of stuff as well. So they had a blast.
She gets into it, man. I saw a picture of her and your daughter like from previous years and then also this year, both being like princesses and mini princesses.
Oh, yeah. No, they love it.
Yeah, she gets into it.
Like I said, I think she likes it maybe possibly more than they do, I think. I don't know.
I think it's a fair statement. Definitely a fair statement.
Nice.
Definitely a fair statement.
Hey, well, we've got some good news and bits and bobs going on. Anything else going on in your world before we move on to some news?
Yeah. I can share a little bit of Voitano stuff. So I guess this week we're finally kind of delivering on some of the things that I had promised to my customers. I'm doing my first office hours later this week, which I guess will be by the time that this episode comes out. If you are a customer, hopefully you were on it. And if not, check your email because they've been recorded and there's places for my customers to get access to them if you've got the ultimate bundle. Also, by the time this comes out, I think the news will start. I will have already put out an email and a little information about it. I'm doing my first ever Black Friday sale. So I'm kind of announcing what I'm doing. Going to have a new offering that I'm offering, basically a live version of my course where we'll do it'll be like a webinar, like a 4-day webinar that I'm going to do in January, giving it, you know, waiting past the holidays and stuff, for 3 hours a day from Tuesday through Friday, a week late in January. So part of the Black Friday is, hey, here's a new offering that I'm going to have, and people can sign up for it. Trying to be mindful of people all over the world, so there'll be an early East Coast option and a late East Coast option. Being able to hit both the European market, they have a 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. is when it would be for them, and then another offering that hits both the West Coast of the U.S. and the one in Australia. The Australian ones and New Zealand. But like Sydney, Australia, I have one where it starts at 8 a.m. So people trying to hit everybody. The one thing that surprised me is when we did the launch day, how many people we had from all over the world, especially APAC, that signed up. So the big thing I'm working on now is getting ready for that sort of stuff, for getting ready for like the Black Friday stuff. And I'll put, by the time this episode is published, an email would have gone out. I'll have a blog post up as well and a page on the Voitano site that kind of explains what's going on. Also, we're doing just a blanket. Everything that I have to sale on Voitanos will be 25% off from Black Friday through Cyber Monday. People can take advantage of, and that'll be out there. So don't worry, you haven't missed out on anything. It was just an email that's just gone out to announce everything. And if you're interested, jump on board. The one thing I will tell you, the one thing that's been really frustrating is that I said that I was going to have regular drops of the course. And since I went live with the course in late September, I haven't published any new chapters yet. By the time this recording comes out, either I have two more that are coming out, that will be out, or will be coming out right around the time this goes live, this episode comes out. And it's because over the last month and a half, I've been trying different ways of recording to try and increase my throughput. And the first two that I did came out really bad, and I had to scrap it all and I had to re-record it. Which is good too, because Microsoft, as we'll talk a little bit in our news, they released a new version of the SharePoint generator, a new version of the SharePoint framework since we last did our episode, and it screwed up my recording. So to go back and kind of change some stuff up. So I think I've got a good thing now to where I'll be able to pump stuff out a lot faster. It's just, from the first release to the second one, it just took longer than I wanted to. So I think I've got a good cadence going now though.
Nice.
Yeah. So how about you? What's going on over at the World Hyperfish office?
We're pretty busy at the moment, actually. I think I've mentioned a couple of times, we launched our Hyperfish Lite product at Ignite, the free version that lets you go manage photos for free in Office 365 and get them all sorted out. That's been going really well, actually. We hit over 1 million users last week for the first time, I guess. Is that the right? Yeah, the milestone. So we hit over 1 million users, which is pretty exciting. But with great use comes great pain. And so we've been, fixing up some different bottlenecks that we've had and different bits and pieces that we've had that have sort of slowed things down a little bit. And, as you get larger and so forth, you find little areas of things that you want to tidy up and make better. So we've been doing a few of those and introducing some new features along the way. So, no, it's been really fun, actually. Really good. It's always nice to wake up in the morning and I get a report that says, here are a bunch of, these are the new customers that signed up overnight, and get to take a look at them. And some of them are small, some of them are, in the tens or hundreds of users. And then periodically you wake up and you're like, somebody just signed up and they've got 500,000 users. you're like, not quite 500,000. I think the largest we've had so far is 384,000 or 387,000 or something like that signed up.
But still, that's a significant chunk. There's like Uber. I mean, of course, you build this for that scale and you've tested for that scale, but when it's not a bunch of test
users. The real world is different. Yeah, exactly. And so that makes me sit up, bolt upright in the morning and go take a look at the telemetry and make sure things are functioning as they should. So now it's been a really fun exercise, actually, watching it all scale and deal with that amount of data. And we've had over 1 million users in the service for quite some time. I think we're approaching over 4 million users, I think, now in total, something along those lines. I forget the number because they change every day. But, we've been dealing with scale for quite a while. But it's different when it's free scale. And by that, I mean, it's different when you don't get a heads up about a large customer onboarding versus you get a heads up about a customer onboarding, right? And so in a paid product, you go sign a deal with a customer for X many hundreds of thousands of users and you're like, cool, they're going to onboard roughly around this time and you get a bit of a heads up and you can make sure you're ready to go for it for that. But when it's free, nobody really tells you when they're going to sign up. So it's a little different.
Gives you confidence in your system, too. And when things go well, it's like, haha, sweet, things are good.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely fun watching, too. You can see the whiteboard behind you with lots of database cues, lines pointing different directions and stuff. Like, don't worry, I'm not spying on you there, but I can just tell data moves around a lot in Hyperfish.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's a bunch there. There's databases and Elasticsearch. And,
there's Rabbit.
And RabbitMQ and containers and the whole nine yards. I think that was an onboarding whiteboard for a dev that was coming on. So yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's a sort of a rough architecture diagram.
Awesome. Looks
hey,
cool.
Hey, we got a bunch of interesting news this week to go through. But before we do that, why don't we break to talk to one of our great sponsors?
While many IT teams struggle with the impact of deploying Office 365, Zscaler customers are experiencing 40% or greater network performance across file download times, as well as TCP and DNS connection times, compared to using next-gen firewalls and UTMs to route Office 365 traffic locally to the internet. While you may know Zscaler is a leader in cloud security, they also have hundreds of customers who are processing over 1.2 petabytes of Office 365 traffic monthly through the Zscaler cloud. Visit www.zscaler.com to learn more. A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, and maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself, though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery, from individual items to entire sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com.
All right, AC, let's get stuck into it.
Sounds good, man. We got some news here. You want to kick us off?
Yeah, so we alluded to it in the intro yesterday, which was November the 6th. Quite a lot of the internet dropped off for the US. And there's a great Wired story that we'll link to in the show notes here, which is called How a Tiny Error Shut Off the Internet for Parts of the US. It's kind of interesting. We are at Hyperfish, we're a Comcast business subscriber. So we get our internet through Comcast, which arguably was a mistake to begin with. But, you know, your mileage may vary. It's actually been pretty good for us on the whole. But yesterday we came in and things like Google would work, but like GitHub wouldn't work. We couldn't get to GitHub, couldn't get to pagerduty.com, couldn't get to a bunch of different sites. And I was wondering, you know, what's going on? Because obviously having the internet kind of is important to your productivity, for us at least. It's where we keep our code and how we run our service and everything. So we started looking into it, and it turns out it wasn't just us. It was a huge number of customers and users, not just from Comcast, but from a bunch of different providers. And it turns out it came down to an error made by Level 3 Communications, which are a rather large provider of internet backbone, I guess, for want of a better word, in the US especially. And so that was causing all sorts of ramifications downstream or upstream, whichever way you look at it, and took off a lot of people out of the US. And it just really, you know, these incidents really go to show how dependent you are, you know, on the internet to get your job done. And so, yeah, we were able to do certain things. I use a VPN provider called Private Internet Access when I'm traveling, just to, you know, if I'm on dodgy Wi-Fi networks and so forth, I use PIA to VPN back into the States or back into somewhere else that where I can be assured of nobody snooping on me or different people snooping on me. And
right. You go about thinking that nobody's snooping on you, CJ.
Exactly.
Go right
ahead. Yeah. Yeah, don't fool yourself. People are snooping on you. Yeah, I VPN'd into California, and it turns out PIA must terminate with a different provider, and I wasn't having those issues. So we were able to get around some of these things, but it really just goes to show how dependent you are on the internet to get your job done. And when small issues like this happen, it takes out huge parts of the country. It also happened to cover up a large outage in the US North Central or something like that area for Azure. They had a pretty large outage yesterday for, I think, 90 minutes on and off. And I don't know if it was related. It could have been related. There were Azure customers having issues trying to get to the compute resources. It definitely sounded sort of connectivity and routing related, which could very well be the same part of the same incident. But anyway, Azure went down at the same time. I don't know if it was the same part, but anyway.
No, that definitely got covered up by this one.
Did you notice this happen?
I didn't notice it happen. For two reasons. One, because I was recording all day for course stuff, but not only that, and everything I was doing was local. Well, I guess not. I guess I was hitting Office 365 in a hosted workbench. But my internet, my backbone is all through AT&T Fiber. I switched over to AT&T Fiber around January of this year, so almost a year ago, from Comcast Business. So I would have been affected by it, but I didn't notice it. All of a sudden, I started seeing people talking about it on Facebook when I jumped on Facebook late last night. I was like, wow, I totally missed it. Usually those things are... That's a big issue for me. That's one that's going to knock me down. So thankfully, it didn't touch me.
Yeah, that's painful. There's a little map that I'll link to in the show notes, which shows sort of a heat map of what was affected and make you realize the sort of the scale of it.
The funniest part of the article that I saw that you linked to here, it was by Level 3, and the quote is, "Our network experienced a service disruption affecting some customers with IP-based services." You're Level 3. You're a backbone. You're a backbone company, man. So what do you not do that's IP-based?
I don't know, actually. You know, maybe that's not a silly question. I'm not sure.
I'm curious. It's kind of like going to a gas station saying, yeah, people that were trying to buy gas from us were affected yesterday. Like, really? So
I just came here for the gum.
Yeah, those hot dogs you have the best hot dogs, said no one ever.
Yeah, fantastic hot dogs. Anywho. Yeah, so that's a little bit of random internet news, vaguely cloud-related potentially with the Azure outage. We've got some Azure news here. Do you want to dive into one of those?
Yeah, definitely. We can jump into these. So the first one here that I found was a bit of news from the media services team, but it really applies to a lot more stuff. It's titled Enabling Azure CDN Directly from Azure Cloud Services Portal Extension. So let's keep it a little simple here. When you want to create, you know, what's a CDN? A CDN is a way for me to, with Azure, I can put stuff in a storage account, like a blob account, and then I set up a CDN and map to that storage account. And now I'll have the files that are in that storage account be cached on the Azure Edge network all over the world for making the files significantly faster. What Microsoft did, let's say if I wanted to use this for my site, so like our podcast site, it runs in an Azure web app using Orchard. And if I wanted that to be, have it be CDN backed, then I'd have to go set up a CDN and then I have to go modify all my URLs. I have to go modify all the URLs to go say use this where the new CDN location is, but they would be two separate resources in Azure and they wouldn't be associated with each other. One of the neat things with this is that they've added this extension to the PaaS service offering from Azure so that now customers can easily enable a CDN to scale a cloud service without leaving the cloud service extension. So it's great for customers who want highly available and scaled out applications and also having a lot more control. And it also is going to give you more control over any of your VMs. What I would really like to see with this offering to kind of take this the next step is I would love to see Microsoft have like a URL rewriting thing inside of Azure so that I could say any URL, like almost make it to where have Azure be like a firewall in front. And maybe this exists. If one of our listeners knows this, then let me know so we can share it with people. But look at all the URLs that are coming from my web application and say, if it matches this kind of a pattern, then rewrite it to be this instead so that out of the blue, I want everything that's inside of this storage blob. I want it to be backed with a CDN or use the CDN links instead. So let me just have the application just work the way it normally works, but then put the CDN in front of it. So
yeah, gotcha.
So that's my first bit of Azure news. Do you want to do the other one or do you want me to do the other one? You do this one.
Yeah, sure. This one I dropped in here. It's kind of a nice, if you're a Linux user in Azure, there was news yesterday or the day before that the Linux Fuse adapter for blob storage is available. Fuse lets you mount a file system, another file system. So it stands for file system and user space, and it lets you mount file systems. So in this case, you can mount a Azure blob storage location as a file system in your Linux VM in a pretty nice and easy way. You could sort of do this with the Azure Files offering, which has like SMB type connectivity to it. You could mount an SMB share in there, but this is kind of a bit deeper. So you can mount them on reboot and do all that sort of stuff and just interact like you would with a regular file system. Kind of nice if you want to store things in there, you know, temporary files or
you need to get access to some data you've stored in blob storage and you want to do some compute over it, you could mount it as a directory or, you know, folder in your Linux VM and get right in there. So yeah, it's a much nicer way to get access to that stuff. And it's a pretty standard way of doing that in Linux. If we've got any listeners that are big Linux users, that might be of interest to you if you use blob storage. Yeah. You'd kind of expect some of these things just to be there, but some of these things are quite hard, weirdly hard. Like, it's bizarre. Like, you just sort of expect to be able to say, oh, I've got a blob storage account. I want to, like, mount it like a drive in my VM. And you're like, well, how do I do that? And like, I don't know.
I ran into that recently with Azure, where I have, when I first started business, I had a bunch of all the different services I was using. There was data coming from those services, being collected by those services, that I know that I needed to process later for some stuff, but I didn't want to take it wasn't going to be anything that changed what I was offering out of the gate. So I was like, you know what? I just want to collect it and I'll go process it later. So I wrote a little Azure function and it dumped every single webhook that I was getting into a blob, but I made a mistake and then I was dropping it all into the root of a blob. So I have a container in Azure storage. Actually, I have four different containers in Azure storage, or sorry, five. Three of the five have only 1,500 or less items in it. One of them, though, has over 700,000 blobs in it, and the other one has over 1.3 million blobs in it, and they're not structured by folders.
That's a lot of next pages.
It's a ridiculous amount, and I tell you, I'm sitting here looking at it, and I've been going back and forth in different forums, and like, so how can I deal with this? And everybody's like, well, use Stream Analytics. I'm like, yeah, Stream Analytics tells me, yeah, there's a lot of things in this one container. We need you to segment it out by folders. And I'm like, yeah, so I can't do that because I first have to figure out how do I get a list of everything that's there and move them over without that service timing out. And I was like, well, they use Data Factory. I'm like, okay, sweet. And they're like, well, that's actually going to be a problem. And I'm like, oh my God, this, isn't it like cloud scale? Shouldn't it make it easier to move this? I've already got it figured out. I've got something that's working now too, Azure Functions and queues to the rescue, but it is, it's just stuff that it's like going, really, I have this problem. Shouldn't this be easier to fix?
Hey, have you found it, out of interest, have you seen any utilities for Mac OS that let you mount an Azure Blob storage account as a drive?
I don't think I have.
I mean, I use the Azure Storage Explorer normally, the app to, you know, cruise around and do stuff in there. What I'd really like is just a drive mount. I wonder if I could use this Fuse one on Mac OS. Probably not. We'll see.
Huh, that's a good question because, you know, so I've never used anything with, I haven't used Azure Files at all. I just use blobs. That's interesting.
No, but, you know, like mount this Azure Blob storage account as a drive.
Yeah, so if I just drop something.
It would be pretty sweet.
Yeah, I mean, my read-write would be a little bit slower, but it would be nice to be able to, yeah, you know, if I want to put stuff in the cloud, it'd be easier than opening up storage and dragging over and blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly. Have to give that a shot.
Interesting.
Excellent, excellent. So that's our Azure news.
I know we have some Office 365 news, but before we do that, why don't we break for another, have a nice little word from one of our sponsors.
Sounds good.
ShareGate makes it easier for organizations to adopt and use the latest Microsoft productivity tools, helping millions of users be happier and more productive at work. ShareGate is trusted by over 10,000 IT admins from over 110 countries to manage, migrate, and secure their SharePoint and Office 5 environments. ShareGate is recognized as the must-have tool for day-to-day administration of on-premises, cloud, and hybrid environments. Interested in learning more? Check us out at ShareGate.com to learn how ShareGate can make you more productive.
All right. On to Office 365 news. You want to kick us off with something juicy, AC?
Oh my God, this is like the plethora of news here. So
the plethora of juiciness.
It really is. It's about, the title of the post was by Kurt Konigsbauer, and the title of the post is New to Office 365 in October. There's a lot. So
everything.
I'm going to blaze through a lot of this.
We should probably just go through them.
Yeah.
The big stuff. Yeah,
yeah, I'll go through. I'm only going to stop on one or two of them to explain them, but here's some cool things. If one of these things interests you, there's a link in the show notes. Go check it out. New features for content creation. There's a translator in Word. There's a Tell Me support for people in documents. There's learning tools in Word on the iPad because it now supports like an immersive reader and read out loud. There's some cloud enhancements. So we know about, you know, OneDrive files on demand came to the Windows 10 Fall Creators Update, as well as support for 3D files in OneDrive. There's something about Visio Online. We should talk a little bit about that. Visualizing your networks with My Analytics. This one's interesting. We saw this at Ignite, LinkedIn profiles and outlook.com. So you saw this in the keynote. Basically what this is that before people flip out about this, what this is that if I go in and I set certain data on my LinkedIn profile as public, then when you go in to using outlook.com, if I send you an email, CJ, and you open it up on outlook.com on your Outlook address, and you hover over my name in the card, if you've connected your outlook.com account over to LinkedIn, then you'll see my public information that I've chosen to make public in that, right inside that card. So not just the stuff that outlook.com knows about, but also LinkedIn, that what LinkedIn knows about. But I think the key thing here, when I first heard this, I was like going, oh, you gotta be kidding me. That's scary. But it's what I have said that I want to mark public. If I don't want it public, it doesn't show up.
Yep, that's fair enough. And actually this same functionality is coming to Office 365 in due course as well. They talked about that at Ignite as well. So it'll be kind of nice being able to see some more contextual information coming from from LinkedIn in line in your contact cards. If you're connected with that person, or if you're signed into LinkedIn, and being able to see some of the public information about that person, I think it'd be really helpful.
Yep. There's a lot more stuff here too. Some updates, 1 billion downloads of Skype for Android, Office 365 gallery, Office Lens, multi-page support, updates to SharePoint, things about using Forms and SharePoint with Power Apps. I did see in my Office 365 tenant, I think that's starting to roll out now. Group insights and Yammer, Office, and then also some, just a couple other things that are there too about some accessibility stuff. And yeah, so there's a bunch of stuff there. There's a couple things that we'll unpack a little bit in some of our other news that we'll talk about in just a few minutes. But it's a huge roll-up of stuff coming that came out in October.
That's pretty sweet. I like that. It's nice that they do sort of roll-up posts, because it's hard to keep up with all the news.
It is. I mean, a monthly roll-up post really, really works. And, you know, another thing, too, I'd like to talk a little bit, too, about some updates that did around the SharePoint framework, that Microsoft released the SharePoint framework. So we had, I guess this was last week, so it was, I think, October the 30th when we recorded it, or the 31st. I'm not sure which one it was, but SharePoint team shipped a new version of the SharePoint framework. And it's interesting how they do this. The SharePoint framework, the version is the current version of the Yeoman generator. So the Yeoman generator for developers that we use is also the version that we look at as what's published on Office 365 and SharePoint Online. They published a version of the generator 1.3.4, and there are a few different updates to it. They made the big change that we saw here, we're supposed to be the big positive change. There's a few negative changes, I think. But the big positive change they did here was some stuff around the Office UI fabric. If you're a SharePoint framework developer or not, and you just have heard about this, that the SharePoint team has had a lot of frustrations with the Office UI fabric, in the sense that they make changes to the Office UI fabric and the React components. And every time that they ship a new version of the SharePoint framework, there's been a lot of challenges that we have with like breaking changes that kick in. And so what the SharePoint team has done is they've tried to make it easier to work with just the core CSS styles instead of working with all of the React components. And so they've created a new package that will by default get added to SharePoint framework projects. It's called the SharePoint Office UI Fabric Core, and it contains a subset of the core fabric styles that are supported in SharePoint. It includes things like typography, layouts, colors, themes, text direction. What's not supported are animations and icons, but you can go ahead and use those inside of SharePoint in your own project. That project that package is added to your projects by default for new projects. You can add it later if you want to existing projects, but that's supposed to make life a little bit easier. I still think it's a little bit frustrating how they've set it up, but regardless. The other thing I think that we did see a couple other changes that have happened with the SharePoint framework. What has been a little disappointing is it's starting to feel like the quality assurance side and the testing of the generator, it seems to kind of gone down a little bit with every release we've gotten. Because, I mean, within 48 hours of seeing a new generator come out, I saw like 6 or 7 new bugs that were like breaking things that like, I can no longer do this. I can no longer do this. And stuff that it's not like, hey, you took a capability away. It's that, hey, I can't build this kind of project anymore with a new generator. And it's just stuff that seems that testing should have caught this stuff. It's a little frustrating. And I mean, I would like to see the team do two things. I'd like to see a little bit better on the testing of stuff before it gets shipped out. And then two, be both a little bit more visible and transparent with what's included with each one of the patches updates. So you have to go into the change log and see what changed from one version of the generator to the next version. And that's not easy to find if you're not familiar with how NPM works. That's one. But the other thing too is that I find it really hard to, the SharePoint, the engineering team has a bit of a knack for when an issue is posted on the issues list, if it gets fixed, it gets tracked inside their own issues tracking thing and it gets fixed, but they close the issue before it's been published as something that we can use as customers. And so I was fighting them.
Closed but not released.
Exactly, yeah. And so I've been fighting them a bit on this. Thankfully, there's some guys that are pretty cool about it. I mean, Vesa Juvenen for Microsoft is being pretty good about reopening things and saying, hey, let's not close this until it's fixed.
And confirmed fixed, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing is, it's like for example, I had an issue that I logged. They said, oh yeah, it's fixed. Well, that'll be fixed in the future or something like that. It's fixed and you'll see a release in the future. And then a new generator comes out 2 weeks later, but it's not included in that fix. And they go, oh, it's coming in the 1.4 release. I'm like, well, when's that coming? Oh, we don't have a timeline for that.
It's developer done, but it's not customer done.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, so if you say it's fixed, then to me it's fixed. But if it's not fixed in my environment, I'm reopening another bug.
Sure.
So
yeah, that seems reasonable.
I would like to see them get that cleaned up. So it's the only place I see where that's the case. And so I don't know. Well, hopefully they'll address that. But
yeah, gotcha.
There's my SharePoint framework rant for the week.
That was pretty mild. Good job.
Oh yeah. Oh, I got more, but I'll wait.
Speaking of circles and squares, Visio Online and Visio's new cloud stuff is coming out. So I think we briefly mentioned Visio Online a couple of shows ago. But basically, this has been a long time coming. The ability to build and interact with Visio documents in a non-read-only mode. I think there's been a Visio Online viewer kind of thing for a while. But this is like proper in quotes, Visio in a browser, much like Word Online or Excel Online, where you can drag circles and squares and so forth and interact with Visio documents. So that's kind of nice because it means that if you use Visio a bunch and you've got Visio documents in a SharePoint in your OneDrive or what have you, or in a SharePoint document library, that you can open those and not have to have Visio installed locally to get in, which is super nice because it's kind of one of those apps that, you know, you have it on a machine, but it's not part of your regular Office install. And so it's kind of a special case and you got to buy it separately and all that sort of stuff. And they're also changing the pricing model. So now they've got Visio Online, which is available in Visio Online Plan 1. So you can buy it as a subscription just for online, the cloud offering, I guess. And Visio Online Plan 2, previously Visio Pro for Office 365. And I believe that is the one that gets you the app as well, you know, the desktop stuff, I think. There's a version comparison here where you can double check. But Visio Online Plan 1 is $5 a month, and Visio Online Plan 2 is $15 a month. Yes, it does. It includes Visio, the application that you download, in Plan 2. So you need Plan 2 if you want to get the desktop application as well. That's why it's $15 a month. Visio is kind of one of those sleeper applications, much like Project in the Office division, which makes a metric buttload of money, but very quietly. If you know what I mean. Like, it's not talked about a lot, but it is used a lot and makes Microsoft a ton of money.
As a Mac user, that is one app that I've missed, is not having the ability to draw, to do like wireframes, to do UML diagrams and stuff like that. And I have to play with this a bit. I would really like to have this ability, both on, you know, from a browser-based perspective, that's perfectly fine. I'd rather be using browser-based tools than thick client apps. But then also having that same capability on like an iPad and being able to interact with stuff on an iPad. And I see that, I mean, there is a Visio viewer for iOS. In the article, it talks a little bit about it allows you to view and interact with Visio diagrams. I don't know, I think interacting, that's more of a read-write experience. That's not just a read-only. So I would like to see that, you know, a little bit more. There's other tools that do some of this stuff, but Visio is the kind of the bellwether of the industry. And that's, wish I could have that same experience on an iPad. But I'm interested to play with this on their site, the website.
I haven't tried it out yet, so I don't know how feature full it is, right? Like, I don't know how close to Visio desktop it is. I suspect it's, you know, similar to Word, where 80% of it is not in the online version, but the most useful stuff is. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if it's good.
Definitely.
Nice.
We got any other Office 365 news?
Yes, they're deprecating some stuff for us developers. This one's kind of a biggie. The Outlook REST API v1.0 and the Office 365 Discovery and Live Connect APIs are being deprecated. So prior to the Microsoft Graph, there were some APIs called the Office 365 Discovery Service, which let you call an API and find out where somebody's Exchange service was, SharePoint service, things like that in Office 365. So you'd call a Discovery service first, you'd find out where those endpoints were, and then you could go call those to get access to the APIs directly for each of those individual services. So this was kind of pre-Microsoft Graph, where now Microsoft Graph has obviously obfuscated this need with one endpoint to call. So anyway, the Office 365 Discovery service is being deprecated. Not only that, but they're doing it on January the 10th. Deprecation begins January 10th, 2018.
That's pretty quick.
Which really surprises me.
That's pretty aggressive.
They say deprecation begins. It doesn't end until November the 1st, 2019. So they're giving you effectively 2 years heads up, which is good, right? 2 years is their standard deprecation policy. They say deprecation begins on January 10th, but it's not until November the 1st, 2019 that it'll be fully decommissioned.
I see. So when they say begins, it means new apps will not be able to access the Discovery service. So basically, it basically just says starting on January the 10th, any Greenfield stuff must use the APIs that they're telling you to use. But if you have any existing stuff, nothing breaks until November the 1st, 2019. So so I take back what I said. That's not aggressive. That's a pretty good window. That's a pretty fair window.
Yes. Along with it come a bunch of SDKs that were built by the Microsoft open source team a few years ago. So there's Office 365 SDK for Android, Outlook SDK for Android, Orc for Android, Azure AD Graph SDK for iOS, Office 365 SDK for iOS, Outlook SDK for iOS, 365 Discovery Service for iOS, OneNote SDK for iOS. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I assume these all make use of those APIs that are being deprecated.
Somebody should have made those a bulleted list instead of putting that as one giant long like sentence.
Maybe the long sentence makes it look shorter. I don't know. But they say, we recommend that you use the Microsoft Graph and the associated Graph SDKs instead. So no surprise. The good thing here is I'm actually really impressed by one thing in particular of this, and that's their approach to the deprecation. So previously in Office 365, especially when I was there, the standard was at least 12-month notice for deprecation of features. And they've actually linked to an article here that says, the deprecation of these APIs follows our service deprecation policies. They link off to that, and it's an article in the Microsoft Graph, of all places, documentation that talks about support policy and deprecation information. And this particularly talks about the Graph, not about other APIs. But in here, they say 24 months after the announcement. So 2-year deprecation policy. So they'll announce it, and then 2 years later, they'll turn it off, which actually seems very reasonable for a cloud API. And I believe it follows Facebook's model almost to the letter. So not a bad policy. Anyway, I think the extra time is excellent because it can cost a lot to get off an API once you start using it.
It definitely does. Hey, you know, we just talked about Office or about Microsoft Graph. Do you mind if I, because you would be a good person to ask this, do you mind if I spring a listener question on you that we got about a couple weeks ago?
Go for it.
All right. This is by, and I apologize if I mess this up, but Bernard Rickenberg, I think that's right. You sent us a message on October the 10th, and it's about how do we report bugs or get support on the Microsoft Graph? Let me read his question in full. It takes a second here. I've enjoyed your sessions about Ignite recently. I'm a big fan and user of the Microsoft Graph. Once in a while, things work not quite as expected in the Microsoft Graph and would love to learn what is the best way to report issues to Microsoft and whether there is some form of support for the API. Office 365 support says that they only support the user interface. Some folks report their bugs in a GitHub repo for the Microsoft Graph where very few get answered. So he's in doubt. And yeah, should APIs be supported as well? Otherwise, it's hard to use them if things don't work as expected, and there's more extensive list. And is there a more extensive list of known issues besides what's published in the Office docs? recently see quite a few issues while creating with creating Office 365 groups with app-only permissions to the Graph API, for instance. Know what that is, CJ?
Maybe.
As I'm working with this intensively, I would like to share these experiences with Microsoft. So what would you say? I mean, you guys are like a huge user of the Microsoft Graph. And I know just from talking to you off the show that you've also experienced some places where you stubbed your toe and actually maybe about app-only permissions with the Graph API.
App-only permissions, exactly, yes. So I guess there's a couple of parts to this. Can you get support for the Microsoft Graph when you hit issues? And my understanding is that is not that you can't, that you absolutely can. So for example, I have absolutely logged production Graph issues through Office 365 support and had them escalated to the right team and have had them addressed. So my understanding is that absolutely Microsoft Graph is supported by Microsoft through regular support channels that you would use for production issues with Office 365. That's the first point. So either you've had an unfortunate experience where somebody has given you the wrong information, or I've been given the wrong information and I've just been supported when I've submitted issues. I think the key there, though, is that when you submit issues, there's a bunch of questions about categorization of the issue. And so maybe it comes down to which category you're submitting it in. I know the ones that we've submitted have mostly been around some authentication and app-only type problems that we've had. And we've had great support on those, actually. We get support through Office 365, obviously, and we also get support through Azure. So I think in the cases past, we've submitted our authentication. I'm trying to remember if we submitted through Office 365 or through our Azure support. It's a good question, and I can't remember which way we went. I believe we submitted it through Azure, actually, strangely enough.
Authentication does make sense if you're doing that. I mean, with Azure, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was an Azure AD issue. Yeah, I think that makes sense, yeah. I believe we submitted it through our Azure support for that case. We got great support on it. But yes, Microsoft Graph is absolutely supported. The second thing is, where do you go for just questions and answers, and do you think you've got it right or not? The best place I've found is Stack Overflow. So the Graph team are quite active in Stack Overflow, and they look on the for questions tagged Microsoft-Graph. So those are, if you ask a question and you tag it Microsoft-Graph, there's plenty of activity on that tag for questions and people answering those as well. So if you've just got sort of dev-related questions, not production, oh gosh, something's broken, or a production-type problem, for developer support, Stack Overflow is probably the best place to go that I've found. And then if you've just got general feature suggestions, the user voice, the Office developer user voice is where you should go log those. And I know for a fact they go and look at those, because I've submitted a number of those myself, and some of them have been resolved and some haven't. It's not as active as I would like, but they definitely look there. And so between those three locations, user voice for feature suggestions and ideas, Stack Overflow for developer questions, and submitting support tickets through either Office 365 or Azure, depending on which what you've got your problem with, whether it's an Azure AD issue or an Office part of the Graph issue. That seems a little sketchy. That would be much nicer to have resolved. Maybe we should chat to Yena about that, about what the right way to log production issues with Microsoft Graph is, and get back to our listeners. But that's the way I've been doing it and having good success with.
I will try to corner her next week and ask her that, because I'm going to be at the SP Live 360 conference in Orlando, and she's going to be our keynote speaker and doing a session there. So I will try to pull her aside and ask her, you know, as a little short, like, you know, what's the best way to get feedback, to get answer questions answered, to submit bugs, to get support, paid support, free support. I'll see if I can get a question on that, an answer on that.
Excellent. So yes, API deprecations, we just mentioned that, 24 months, nice. Any others on Office 365, AC, before we move on? No, I think we're all good there.
I'm Office 366, so I'm done with the year.
Fair enough. Hey, before we move on to our picks, why don't we briefly chat to one of our sponsors? CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users in organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
All right, AC. It is that time, my friend.
I love that time.
I love this time of the show, mainly because I find out about really fascinating things from you that I would have not have otherwise. So what have you got for me this week?
I'm the exact opposite, right? I'm flip side, same thing. It's like you say something like, oh, this is cool. I didn't know about this. This one I couldn't wait to share with you. I sent it to you and I said, hey, I got dibs on this being a pick, but you're going to love this. You got to read this ahead of time.
Yep. It was fascinating.
Yeah. These things are really cool. Scary as hell, but thankfully they're in the history and not present day. The title of this?
That you know of.
Oh, yeah. I'll find out about it in future if it's today.
Yeah.
This one is titled 53-Year-Old Nuclear Missile Accident Revealed. Ruh-roh. Let me just read the first three very short paragraphs here. Actually, four paragraphs. And then I'm going to let everybody else go listen to it. I'm just going to tell you, it's fascinating. So, quote, Bob Hicks was spending a cold December night in his barracks 53 years ago at the Ellsworth Air Force Base near Rapid City when his phone rang. I think Rapid City is in North Dakota. I think that might be right. Something like that. It was the chief of his missile maintenance team who dispatched Hicks to an incident in an underground silo. Quote, the warhead, the team chief said, is no longer on top of the missile. Hicks eventually learned that a screwdriver used by another airman caused a short circuit that resulted in an explosion, and the blast popped off the missile's cone. The part contained the thermonuclear warhead and sent it on a 75-foot fall to the bottom of an 80-foot-deep silo. Guess who had the pucker factor going?
Somebody had a bad day at work.
Oh, my God. Later on, it just goes through, and Hicks says, that was enough to cause me to get dressed pretty quickly.
Yeah. I love these stories. I think longtime listeners of the show will remember us talking about the book Command and Control that we've both read or listened to. That book details a bunch of incidents that are like this. And it's surprising the number of times there have been accidents and incidents like this, similar to this, some worse, some not as bad, and the luck involved in there never having been a nuclear detonation over US soil due to an accident. It's staggering how close it's come a number of times.
It really is. And not only that, those accidents, it's amazing how those accidents too, each one of those accidents could have easily caused, World War III, because if one of those things goes off and, it's going to vaporize everything around it, well, everyone outside of that range is going to know, hey, a nuclear bomb just went off, and they're not going to think accident. They're going to think attack. And so the triggers are on the fingers.
Well, the shape of that cloud doesn't look like one of ours.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. And so, who knows? And that's just
it's horrible to think about, isn't it?
The book that you and I both read, that Command and Control book, it is fascinating because it really shows not only how good how good our luck was, but it also shows how good the fail-safes were and what it really, it's not easy to detonate a nuclear weapon, thankfully.
Yeah. Yeah, it turns out it's North Korea, if you're listening, I hope you're finding it difficult.
And continue to.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really cool. I read that article end to end after you'd sent it to me, and it was just fascinating. Really interesting to see these details come to light.
My other pick is a book that I just finished. God, this was really interesting. And you want something heady, geeky. This is a good one. It's called Code Warriors, the NSA Codebreakers and Secret Intelligence War Against the Soviet Union. I listen to it as an audiobook. I listen to these when I'm doing, when I'm training for, a big run. I have a half marathon coming up. And on my longer runs, I try to keep my pace in check and go, fairly like a minute or two slower than I normally go per mile. So this does a really good job of just letting me kind of settle into a routine and then just focusing on the book. This whole thing was about really starting from the very beginning of the NSA, how the NSA got formed and how the turf wars between the CIA and the NSA, and then how all the stuff they did to really just try and snoop and listen in on the Soviet Union. This pretty much stops right up at the fall of the Soviet Union. It doesn't go much further beyond that. I thought it was going to go a little bit farther than that. But it was really interesting. I mean, it's all the old school stuff. It's like manual code breakers or code warriors, meaning like the humans that were breaking codes and creating codes and working through the enigmas and all that kind of stuff, the enigma machines and the Turing machine, stuff like that. I found it really good, really interesting.
That sounds really cool. I have to listen to that for sure. Hey, I've got a couple real quick.
The first one is called 16 Amazing Color Corrected Photos from the Apollo Missions. If you want a new phone background for your fancy new iPhone X that you may or may not have, listeners, these make some pretty sweet backgrounds. So it actually happened a while ago, but yeah, a guy has used his mad Photoshop skills to color correct and level balance and do all that sort of stuff. 16 of these amazing Apollo, which are just beautiful. So definitely worth to check those out. We'll link to those in the show notes. And then the second one is, you know, some humans are awesome. And sometimes you come across stories that just blow your mind away and you're like, wow, I'm really not living up to my proper expectations that I have for myself as a human. This one is called Meet the 70-Year-Old Runner Who Ran 7 Marathons on 7 Continents in 7 Days. A lady by the name of Chow Smith celebrated her 70th birthday by running 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 consecutive days, 7 consecutive days, all while wearing a pink pussy hat. There you go.
Oh, okay, it's a cat hat. Okay, good. I'm just making sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, some people just beat your expectations. And this woman nailed it. She used to think running was a boring sport. She thinks a bit differently now and decided between January 25th and 31st, 2017, she ran marathons in Perth, Australia, Singapore, Cairo, Egypt, Amsterdam in the Netherlands, Garden City, New York, Punta Arenas in Chile, and the King George Island Antarctica Marathon.
That is incredible. This is absolutely...
Isn't it?
I mean, running one is incredible. Running two in 2 days is incredible. Running seven in 7 days, I can't fathom that. And then dealing with the travel of having to get from continent to continent and then doing it, you have no time to recover. I don't know how she physically did this. This is incredible.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? So she's a survivor of the Vietnam War as well. Came to the US and there's a whole story behind her and what she's achieved. Pretty cool.
Man, that and these pictures, good pics this week, man. These pictures are incredible.
They're pretty nice. Hey, AC, great show. Thanks for coming this week. Like every week, fun to catch up.
Absolutely, man. Good show again. I'll talk to you soon.
Cheers. Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. We'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as an MP3 or WAV file and provide a link so we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up for our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.